I'd like now to welcome Zachary Irving. He is writer and director of the film Nothing Without You, which screens as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival on Saturday at 4 o'clock at the CCA. And Zachary will be there along with other members of the film's crew and cast to introduce the film and do the Q&A. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So this is, I have to say, I'm very partial to this film. I really like it a lot. And it's a psychological thriller and murder mystery. And the protagonist is this mentally ill woman who witnesses a murder, and then she's accused of it. But of course, almost no one believes her because she has a pretty sketchy history. What, first of all, is the inspiration for this story?
Well, I think suspense thrillers are always a lot of fun to write and certainly to direct. So I knew I wanted to make a film like this. And, you know, the king of suspense thrillers is Hitchcock. Most of his films have a male protagonist lead.
Yeah.
And I really wanted, for some reason, to have a female lead. And I really wanted to explore some of the psychological landscape of a character who's mentally ill in the lead role, because I think we'd have a lot of fun with guessing through her perspective what's real and what's not. So that was kind of the things we played with and had a lot of fun writing the script and making the film.
I would think that when you're writing a film like that, you have to be really careful about making it realistic to whatever her, for lack of a better word, diagnosis is. Did you have to kind of research that type of person and the kind of illness that she has?
Yes. I mean, every film certainly has its reality that it establishes and has to be true to for the film to work and be consistent. Our film plays with that sense of reality, and it certainly plays with the relationship of a woman who, as an audience, we're not sure of. Is she innocent or is she guilty of murder? Is she experiencing reality or not? And her relationship with a court-appointed psychiatrist who she meets in the first few minutes of the film to help her sort of navigate the story and sort of navigate, you know, this mystery of unraveling what's really happening, what's not.
And that question is one throughout the film for her and for the audience, and when you get to the end, you just want to go back and watch the whole thing from the start again.
Great. Well, we hope that's the case. We wrote a film that had a few twists in it, and you know, part of the fun of that is, in my experience of watching films that are made like that, like The Machinist, The Sixth Sense, Memento. You know, obviously, films on a lot bigger scale and a bigger budget, but We aspire to a story similar to that, because the first time you see it and you experience these twists, you know, it's, for lack of a better word, a pleasure in discovering it. And then there's the second viewing you have where you come into it knowing what the twist is and you see the clues early on. And then
right.
You can really enjoy it for some of the character relationships. So, you know, this was something we used as a model for our story. And fortunately, we found an actress, Emily Fredenberg, who just really became the character in such a way in her preparation that, you know, so much rides on her performance. She really helped us, you know, create a film that allows us to enjoy following a main character who, upon first or second or whatever viewing, you know, people are comfortable watching the film, can really get lost in it.
She is really perfect in that role. It's kind of spooky how good she is and how real she is. And I have to say, I mean, you guys are a presumably quite low-budget independent film producing group, and you made this film with very good production values. One of the things that I love about independent films is that there's no car chases. There's not an excessive amount of shooting. You know, you actually rely on the script and the acting and the tension of what is actually the drama, as opposed to any of those expensive special effects, to make it work.
Well, we spent a lot of time on the script, and, you know, your film, the adage is, you know, your film's never better than your script. You know, we watched a lot of thrillers, too, and used those as models and then bounced, you know, sort of made our own based on how the character formed over many drafts. You know, part of the research I did, I did some volunteer work at a psychiatric center, so I kind of got to know the world of my character, you know, who has a background in that. But, you know, really, so much of that tension comes from the characters and their interplay. So we, you know, took our time with writing it. And as far as getting as high production value for as low as money, as, you know, a low budget as we had, I took a lot of lessons from my day job. I produce documentary television for a living, and a lot of the productions that I've worked on, as well as producing and also shoot them and edit them. I didn't edit this film, but I did shoot it, and we used the Red One camera, and we used you know, a very modest lighting package and a very small crew, and we shot sort of like almost documentary style. We had a shot list, but many times based on what the actors were doing, we'd sort of throw the shot list away and cover the scene intuitively. In other words, shooting it almost like a documentary to really focus on what was in front of the screen and capturing the performance in a way on camera that really lent itself to the interactions of our characters.
Did the actors participate at all in developing the script, and was there any kind of improvisation or last-minute changes while you were shooting?
You know, there were some last-minute changes, but with a psychological thriller, so much of the story points and the way the lines are written really carry through to the next scene and ultimately to the ending.
Yeah.
So if an actor had an idea, we try to entertain it and maybe get a take with a variation of a line, but we were careful to stay as true to the script as possible, using it as a roadmap for a kind of a roller coaster ride of a plot line.
I was watching it and was aware of the music, but I was so caught up in the drama that I wasn't really paying close attention to it. But I think on the second viewing, I probably would more. The use of music is very important in this drama as well.
I think, yeah, sound in general and certainly music is so important in a psych thriller. We were so lucky to meet Victoria De La Vega, who will be actually at the screening. She's flying into Santa Fe this week. She did a marvelous job. This is her first feature film. She's done a few shorts, and she's working on features and television shows now. But we met her through New York University's, they have a program, a master's program for film scoring. And the chair of that program, Dr. Renz von Sadoff, introduced us to Victoria, and she was just perfect. She had some terrific ideas and actually wrote a song that has lyrics for one of the love scenes, so to speak. If you see the film, you'll see it's not quite a love scene, but has a lot of those elements. She wrote a song with lyrics, kind of a jazz tune, that, you know, certainly wasn't anything we thought of, but works so well in the film. So she certainly has these cues that really influence some of the feeling. You know, there's certainly a visual mood we try to create in the film, but the music and some of the cues, I think, on almost in a subliminal level, take you through some of the story and underscore some of the plot points really well. And she did a terrific job.
So independent narrative feature film, how do you finance something like that and get it made?
Well, the first step was to get it done for as little money as possible. I saved money for many years to get the budget together. Of course, you know, we tried to fundraise. We tried to get film budget, you know, on a higher level, a more traditional way, trying to get name talent and investment and all that. But it was taking so long, and it's a project in itself. So we did it bare bones. We had a very small crew. At times, actually, the crew was, you know, one person, me, or sometimes two people. But generally, you know, we had a crew of about 8 or 10 people, depending on the day. But we shot with natural light. And, you know, the equipment that is available today allows you to really take advantage of having kind of a modest package of, lighting and a very small crew and execute really well, because you can see and hear right away what you're getting. and know that you have it in the can, as opposed to, you know, camera tests and pre-lighting. It goes a lot faster when you can see right away where your setup is. So
exactly.
We had an aggressive schedule. We shot 188 scenes, and principal photography was about 4 weeks, and we had about another 2 weeks of pickups over the course of more than a year, actually, while we were post-producing the film. But in other words, we just kind of put a traditional kind of sense of how, you know, the division of labor is done, and we just had a crew that worked together and filled a lot of different roles, focusing, again, what was in front of the camera and making sure, you know, the money that we spent was producing as high production value for as low a budget as we had.
We're talking to Zachary Irving about the film Nothing Without You. So what's next? I mean, having made this film, do you then try to go the Hollywood thriller route, or what are you going to do?
That's a good question. You know, we're so focused on our festival run right now, and certainly in the short term coming to Santa Fe to screen the film, that, you know, it seems like, you know, gearing up for another production seems like the last thing on our minds right now. But no, I have been developing another psychological thriller with a female lead that has sort of a similar storyline in many ways, but has a kind of a, maybe even a darker kind of world that we would sort of have the same production model, you know, shoot very inexpensively, you know, spend the money for stuff that's on the screen and have a really flexible kind of production plan to get it done. But, you know, it's a great time to make films. You know, the technology, the equipment is very affordable. I think there are, you know, really great audiences for filmmaking, particularly with film festivals like the Santa Fe Film Festival, and online, and you know, certainly digital distribution on iTunes and Amazon. There's so many venues to find your audience, and certainly with social media, reaching out to people who like psychological thrillers. You know, there are alternatives to a traditional Hollywood route to finding your audience these days. And I think even big Hollywood films are using non-traditional grassroots efforts to find their audience even before the film is made. So we're exploring ideas of, you know, how do we get people hooked into a storyline? For this film, you know, we've created some web videos of Jennifer Stidger, our main character, in these mock therapy sessions before the story of the film begins, so that audiences can get a sense of who she is and even some clues into this plot line before they see the film. And we have a similar idea for the next film to sort of get, you know, sort of, they call it transmedia, I guess you could call it DVD extra material that goes online that people can sort of play with the world that you create even before you shoot your film. So that's one of the things we're exploring doing for the next film.
Zachary Irving is writer and director of Nothing Without You, which screens, it's part of the Santa Fe Film Festival, on Saturday at 4 o'clock at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts. And Zachary and Emily Fradenberg, who is the lead actress in the film, and a bunch of others from the film will be there. We look forward to meeting you, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Look forward to seeing everybody there. Rick Santos will be there too, producer and co-writer.
Excellent.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. I'd like now to welcome Olympia Stone. Her documentary, The Cardboard Bernini, screens at 2 o'clock this Saturday at the CCA in Santa Fe. It's part of the Santa Fe Film Festival, and she will also be participating in a panel discussion at 8 in the morning at the Hotel Santa Fe called Art on Film. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is a documentary about an artist, Jimmy Graschow, who created an extraordinary artwork. He built a version of Bernini's Trevi Fountain, which is an amazing marble fountain in Rome. He built it out of cardboard. It sounds crazy, but it's an absolutely beautiful, grand undertaking. How did he conceive of this? How did this come into being?
Well, we talk a little bit about that in the film. It's really an idea that he first had, I think, about maybe 10 or 15 years ago. He teaches cardboard workshops and art students all over the world, and he was invited to teach a group of students in Italy, and he thought it would be an amazing idea to build an amazing cardboard fountain and sneak it into a piazza and leave it overnight and sort of freak people out with it. But the whole thing never happened. So I think that was the first time that he really thought about doing something like this. And then he shelved the idea and came back to it. I guess he started this project in 2007. So that's when he started building it.
Right, right. Now, his use of cardboard, it's both an art medium and it's a metaphor. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's so many. He talks about how cardboard and people share sort of the same DNA. Cardboard is garbage, and it's, he says in the film, it's so grateful to be rescued from being trash, which I love.
Yeah.
And that humans and cardboard have this, you know, that we're both mortal, and that we have, you know, we have this imminent, or maybe not so imminent, but we all face the same kind of disintegration in the end. And I also love the fact that he's taking something that is trash and making it into something so beautiful. You know, it's hard to believe that this is something that we encounter every day, the cardboard box. You know, it's a, you know, you toss it aside, you don't think about it, but he's taking it and really transforming it into something unexpected.
It really is. I mean, our friends out in Radio Land are listening right now. Probably half of them are going, yeah, right. But you see this movie, and it's, you know, you don't know how he does it. And the thing that, I you come to love this guy, Jimmy, because he's an amazing artist, and he's also so honest and humble. I mean, he says early in the movie that he's finally embraced the title of artist. He calls himself an artist. But when you look at his life, I mean, he's been doing incredible work since he was a small child, and has never been kind of like, it seems like, super egotistical about it, even though he's been quite successful.
That's right. I mean, Jimmy is really, at his very core, is an artist. I mean, deep down, and I think that really comes across in the film. He has spent his whole life kind of struggling with all of the realities of being a working artist, which is, you know, rejection and, but also wonderful things. I mean, he's had a wonderful career, and, you know, I look at him now, he's 70 years old, and he's kind of said to me, you know, he did struggle for a long time, I think, with being able to call himself an artist, and, you know, he's over that now. I mean, I think he really feels like this is what he has dedicated and devoted his life to, and he absolutely deserves the title. But he is very humble, and yet when you see the body of his work and how extraordinary talented, it's not just building these amazing things in cardboard, but he's a phenomenal woodcut artist. I mean, he's probably the most, you know, I mean, I can't even, I don't know who you could compare him to today, but that's a whole nother career that he has going on. And, you know, he's just an exceptionally talented and magnificent human. I mean, I think he's a philosopher, you know?
Yeah. Well, and part of it, I mean, part of the deep understanding of art and mortality and cardboard and all the things that he talks about in the film is the reality that an artwork is not just about getting an idea and bringing it to completion and displaying it. There's the rest of it where it is seen, enjoyed, and then it decays and becomes, and it basically dies and becomes nothing again. And that is the part that we don't like to think about as human beings, who know that we're going to die and everybody we love is going to die, and that artists don't really like to think about in their artwork. But it's basically kind of Buddhism 101. Everything is impermanent.
Yes, exactly. Yes, I mean, I don't like to use titles or whatever, but I mean, I consider myself a Buddhist. I meditate every day, and I think of this whole film in very Buddhist terms, because it's really about letting go and really grappling with the temporary nature of our existence. And I think that it isn't something that we like to think about very much, but he's really struggling with these ideas. And I think embarking on this journey was a way for him to really go through it and to kind of challenge himself to see if he could do it. And, you know, and I do think it, you know, it's not that it didn't take a toll. I mean, I think it's a tough thing in a way to put yourself through what he did, but I think it's very beautiful and admirable.
And, you know, there's a funny, like, escape hatch from the mortality thing, which is that you've made this film.
Yes.
So the film exactly. lives on.
And he has said he doesn't know deep down if he would have, although I disagree with him on this because I think he was very committed to follow this idea through, but he says, you know, he has grandkids and he wants a record for them of some sort. So I think the fact that I was documenting it obviously made it easier to let go of in the end.
And the letting go was basically after it was displayed at a museum, it was put outside in another museum courtyard where it was going to rain, and it rained, and in fact the thing, I mean, didn't quite return to the earth, but basically was destroyed.
Right. Yeah. No, it was and honestly that was back in April when that happened, and I think it's, you know, he's still working through all of that. I mean, like I said, it was a physically demanding project for him, and I think that you know, it did take its toll to do all of that. And it's not that he will make something amazing again. I'm sure he will because he's such a creative person. But I do think he's still in sort of the gestating phase, you know.
It's interesting. I mean, you see him having made probably the grandest artwork of his life and then seeing it destroyed. What is he, you say it's, he's still kind of digesting it, but what's he working on now? Is there?
Every time I talk to him, he says something different. I think he's casting around. I mean, I think he's always got stuff going on. He does cardboard workshops. He does these, you know, teaching stints where he'll go and build things on site at different, you know, colleges or museums or things like that. So it's not that he isn't too busy all the time. You know, he's very busy and he's really a working artist. I mean, it's not like he can rest on his laurels and not work. So he's working, but has he kind of found the next big thing? I don't think so yet, but yeah. I have a lot of confidence that he will. I think it's just a matter of time.
How did you come to do this documentary?
Well, I grew up with his work in the house that I grew up in because my father was his art dealer for almost 50 years. And Jimmy's work had a visceral, it was terrifying. I mean, it terrified me as a child. He had big, giant, 15-foot tall papier-mâché men. Some of them, we had a piece called Murder Mâché where they're all strangling each other. And it's comical on one hand, but it's also, you know, their eyes are bloodshot and their tongues are hanging out. It was very terrifying. I always thought they were going to come alive when I was, you know, sneaking down to get a glass of milk at night, and I would run past them really quickly. So I think that, you know, his work is wonderful because it's very accessible. There's nothing you need to get about what he's doing. It's kids get it, adults, you know, and anybody can understand and access this work. But I do think that people mistake it for being sort of cute and comical, which it is on one hand, but just like Jimmy, it's got a sort of a tormented edge to it. So it's kind of you know, it's kind of dark at the same time, and I definitely picked up on that as a kid. So I've loved his work forever, and I've known him for my whole life practically. And you know, and I go through in the film, there is a story of how the film actually came to be, which has to do with my father and Jimmy and one of his artworks. And And it was a very organic process of how the film came after that. So I don't want to give too much away.
Yes, I was going to say. Well, we really want to encourage people to go see the film. It's called The Cardboard Bernini by Olympia Stone, and it screens at 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon at the CCA in Santa Fe. And you will also be participating in a panel discussion on Saturday morning at the Hotel Santa Fe called Art on Film.
Right, and I'll be doing a Q&A after the film also.
Right. And by the way, what's your website?
It's floatingstone.com, because there also are some outtakes from the film, you know, things that aren't in the film on there and stuff like that.
Okay, wonderful. Floatingstone.com. Olympia Stone, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe George Jussel and Brooke Fuller. George and Brooke are co-writers of the film, and George is director of the film Little Dancer, which screens this Saturday night at the New Mexico History Museum at 7:15. It's part of the Santa Fe Film Festival and will be followed by a panel discussion. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Nice to be back in Santa Fe.
So this is a very beautifully made, deeply affecting film about a young ballerina from a small village in an unnamed country, presumably somewhere in Eastern Europe, who has the opportunity to audition for a dance academy in the big city. And it's a story set against a background of poverty and war and human trafficking. We aren't going to tell our listeners the whole story of the film because we don't want to give it away, because it's just
Good
a
idea.
Fascinating story. But some of the themes in it, especially this theme that's in the background of human trafficking, are very, very important to talk about. How did you come to make this film and to work together on it?
You want to start?
Sure, I'll start. We actually initially wrote a different script, working on another project, which is set in a later time from this story. And as we were developing that, we became so fascinated by the evolution of our protagonist and how she had reached this stage in her life that we kept referencing it in our story over and over. And as time went on, we realized we had come up with a completely separate story. And so we took a trip to the country where we filmed this, Montenegro, and we drove the entire country from east to west, north to south, and it just started to come to life for us.
It's a, by the way, beautiful, beautiful place. There's land and water there that I'd never seen before and really, really couldn't place. I assume you chose it not only to tell the story, but just because it's incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, it was. We were looking for a location that was not depressing by any means, but it needed to be uplifting, to be a nice little backdrop. And I had received a tip-off from a filmmaker friend of mine in Vienna, and he said, well, why don't you check out Montenegro? It seems to be a great place. It seems to be perfect for your story. So Brooke and I hopped on a plane. We flew down to Montenegro, and we took a rental car, and we literally drove about 30 minutes in one direction and then turned left for no reason whatsoever, and we stumbled across scene after scene, location after location. It was perfect, and we said, wow, this is amazing. You know, half an hour out of the plane, and the scene is here, and that scene is there, and there's props already. And it was fantastic because we had, like, for example, we had a scene that played on a local football pitch, and I said, Brooke, look here, this is where we could have our soccer scene. And there was a soccer ball there in the bushes, and In our story, we imagined that the girls needed to clean the sheep off the field ahead of the game, and there were the sheep just across the wall.
Yeah.
And it went on, and we turned left and we turned right. It was just totally fantastic. And then the magic of it, if you just imagine, was that after we had found the location, within half hour, we drove up and down the country just to make sure we didn't miss any other locations. We didn't find any. We literally ran into the locations that we wanted within the first hour.
Amazing.
So it was really like an... I said to Brooke, that's an indication from above.
Yes, this is the way to do it. Yeah, for sure.
True, though. No?
Yeah.
That's how it was, yeah.
So here you are, an American and an Austrian, making a film in Montenegro with a Ukrainian cast in Russian.
Yeah.
I mean, why Russian?
Well, to me it was clear that the Santa character used to be a believable ballerina. In other words, a 15-year-old girl that really knew how to dance. So, and in our case, it was classic ballet, and we needed a classic ballet expert at 15 years old that looked the part, looked gorgeous and fantastic, and wasn't 17 or 19 or anything like that. And I started to cast on other jobs that I did as a commercial film director in Moscow and Kiev and Poland and Warsaw and in Czech Republic, all the hubs that you would normally think of producing great ballet dancers, young ballet dancers. And I've cast, I think, I'd say 500-600 people. And amongst the last that I cast was Tatiana, Stephanie Seymour, which is a coincidence because there's a Stephanie Seymour.
I know, it's very confusing on the Internet Movie Database because you get this 40-year-old supermodel instead of this 15-year-old.
No. This is Stephanie Seymour. That is her name, her given name, out of Kiev, and she is a ballerina, and she studies with the Ballet Academy in Kiev, and she looked the part, and I wanted utmost authenticity, so I decided that everybody around her, because she wasn't English speaking or any other language, needed to be speaking in the same language. So I started to cast the rest of the cast in Kiev. They were all Ukrainian. In the Ukraine, you speak Russian. Russian is the first language from the Soviet days. They do have Ukrainian language, but Russian is the language. And then we needed a crew. The crew needed to understand what the cast were saying. And so the crew started to be mostly Ukrainian. Then we mixed some Austrian people into it. And that's how that mélange of different nations came about.
Now, how did the two of you come to work together?
Well,
we were friends first here in Santa Fe. And I had been writing for a long time and looking to create a partnership with someone that we could move forward. And because it's really tough to just be a writer. There are so many of us out there. And you may have 10 scripts, but unless you're out there in Hollywood with an agent, you're not going anywhere. You can just, you know, tell all your friends here that you're a writer, and it doesn't mean anything. When I met George, I thought this is going to be a great opportunity, and we just clicked really well. And we actually started writing a script about what we knew, which is New Mexico. And so we wrote a version of a Santa Fe script, which we hope to make someday.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, we realized that, you know, again, it's the challenges you meet in the industry of, you know, how do you break in? George is a very successful commercial director, but as far as being a feature film director, that doesn't really carry a lot of weight. So we wanted to make a movie at all costs, and this was the way for us to have something, and hopefully we'll get some distribution coming out of the festival, and further projects will be put in place.
Well, it is the classic, beautifully made independent film, presumably shot for not a whole lot of money, is that right?
Yeah, it's for sure it's a shoestring budget, but we're not, I don't want to give away the price tag because it has nothing to do with the end result. The end result matters, and if it's good or not, whatever cost was incurred is the second question.
Well, and I think, I mean, to me, it's a movie, and I've looked at your commercial reel online, and of course, you're an amazing filmmaker and have shot all kinds of commercials for major companies, and they're so good. And so, as I was watching this film, I was thinking, this is as well as a film that really everybody should see, because it's such an important set of themes. It's also a film that filmmakers should see, because the craft of it is so subtle, and there are ways that just simply the shot of, for example, a road, and that shot is held for an extra second or two, builds a kind of suspense in the mind of the viewer that you don't really know what's going to happen, but it's just very beautifully crafted.
Well, thank you very much for your kind words. For me, it's a personal adventure, really, because certain things happened and were brought to me in my life that made me aware of the issue of human trafficking. If I can tell you about that, it'd be
sincere. Well, let's do that, because again, it's part in many ways part of the film, even though we don't actually see very much, but it's there and it's so important. How did this subject, which is I think terribly underreported in the media, come to your attention?
The first time I remember being pushed into that direction was when I saw a picture of a African child. I think the guy was about 8 or 9 years old, and people were looking for donators who would facilitate an operation, necessary operation on the guy's skin. He had what appeared to be a horrible skin disease on one half of the body. It looked like half elephant, half person. And I asked about the reasons why the guy looked like that, and they told me that he was supposed to be a child soldier, and he had refused to become a child soldier, so they put him on a griddle and they grilled the boy. And that was the first time when I got really sensitive to the abuse on children. And later on, as I told you and Brooke, as we talked about before, when I lived in Vienna, I had a brothel in the first floor of my house, which is a relative posh neighborhood.
There was
in
a
Vienna.
Brothel on the first
there
floor of your
yeah,
house.
Yeah, there was. Yes, exactly. And a friend of mine came in from Los Angeles. He said, "George, oh, how cool! You have a brothel in your house." And I said, "Well, it's maybe not that cool because I just found out that there's a father with a daughter that is running the business, and the daughter, to my view, could have been maybe 14 or 15 years old, so it wasn't all that funny, really." And it made me think about how people perceive prostitution, how they perceive the whole area, what they think, and what it really is on the other side. And then during the German World Cup in 2006, they had a massive import of prostitutes to the games, and they set up trailer camps where they flushed people through on a green light, red light basis. People were walking into the trailer to have sex with the prostitutes, walked out on the other side. So was it like a traffic light, red, green, red, green, red, green, people going through. So all those things being brought together made me think, and I got sensitized to the issue, and I started to interview people, and I met people that were actually human trafficked out of Africa and other places, and I started to educate myself and read a lot and meet people and people that had done studies and so on, and that's how it came about.
And so people are brought from usually third world countries of one kind or another, whether it be Africa or Eastern Europe or wherever, to Western countries, and the way they're brought over and the way they're treated, they don't know at the beginning what they're getting into, but it's very brutal and it's very hard to get out.
Well, there's a mix, to be totally truthful, and that is really important, to be totally truthful. You can't paint a rosy picture one way or the other. As a matter of fact, there is a large percentage of women who know what they're getting into, and they voluntarily do it. Of course, they're being told the nice aspects. You'll make a lot of money, and it will be not as bad, and then you'll return to your home with all the money and blah, 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 that kind of thing. And women probably persuade themselves that it's better to go that route instead of starving and instead of having a miserable life, and then they do it and they find themselves in a completely different set of circumstances. Many start using drugs and then it's a downhill road from there. But that's the most positive side of the business. The other one, it's a minority, but it exists, and it involves children, underage people. It involves people that are simply forced into into human trafficking and prostitution. There's organ harvesting. There's anything you can think of. And what most viewers and listeners probably don't know, how large of a business it is. It's a gigantic business, and it almost rivals tourism right now. And it's a multi-billion dollar business, and a lot of people are making profits on the illegal side, and there's millions of victims on the other side.
It is pretty daunting, the idea that human trafficking is just about as big as tourism as a business, but of course it's not. It's run by often basically the equivalent of mafias.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think what's really striking is that the world at large perceives human trafficking with as much of a blasé attitude as they do tourism. And I can remember back in 2006 when George called me from Vienna expressing an interest to work on this project, and he told me about the sex trailers in Berlin. And to me, I remember thinking, wow, it's like prostitution McNuggets, you know? Yeah. And it was the first time that I really confronted that lack of empathy that so many of us have for human suffering. And as I looked at it more and more, I felt that what I wanted to tell was a story that would make people have empathy. And I realized that by doing it in a sensationalist way is maybe not the best way to go about it, because we see so much sensationalism on screen and in other related media, that to do a different or to take a different path to create an empathy with a character, with someone that you like, as opposed to someone who's really cool and has guns and stuff like that, would be a much more effective way to get our message across. And I hope, if nothing else, we've really done that with this project.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it was a very affecting movie for me, and I'm looking forward to seeing it again. It raised for me the question of the way women, first of all, are stigmatized. So if a woman is taken into what is essentially slavery, if a woman is human trafficked against her will, or even if, like you say, a woman is trafficked and she's kind of signed up for it, those women are the lowest of the low in society, and we do not have, at least because there hasn't been the media, there haven't been the movies made, we don't really have an image of these people as human beings or people who are victims of a much larger system.
Right. We just see them as victims, pure and simple, and there's so much victimhood in all other aspects in the world, too, that I think there's only so much that an individual can take in and continue to have empathy. The rest we just block out, and, you know, we have our own lives to lead as well.
Or we see them as victims, or we see them as prostitutes and write that off.
That too, which is even more sad.
Yeah, I think you need to get the full picture, including all the colors, including even the so-called evil guys having a background and having a backstory. It's not that clear-cut. You say, this is a good guy, this is the bad guy, and that's it. And then you walk away, you pose a judgment, you can go back to sleep. This is more involved and more complicated than that. Everybody's, in my opinion, everybody's fighting for survival one way or the other. And in the field of those places that we are talking about, where those stories are happen most of the time, this is even more so than in the West. People are fighting for survival, and I'd like to encourage an open view even to the lives of these criminal guys, why they do that, what their background looks like, because I believe if you get the full picture without judgment, you walk away with a willingness to help and support, as opposed to check it off and do something else. And I think, to me, that's very important, that we all, when we are exposed to the heavy set issues, that we walk away with something that we want to contribute or do, and not just know and discard.
Well, and I think it's important, again, Americans are kind of trained to think in polarized ways, black and white, good guys, bad guys, mm-hmm. Democrats, Republican, whatever your polarity
is. No question.
That's just the way we're brought up, unfortunately. And I think the best works of art and the best films are ones that do not put moral judgment on their characters, but let each one play out the life that he or she is given. And this movie really does that.
We had a lot of moments when we were writing the scripts where we came to those forks in the road. And, you know, would we make someone, would we be evil? Would they commit an overtly evil deed? And, you know, our solution has, for the most part, to stay in the middle and to make it gray, because what George is talking about, without the easy casting of judgment, it makes for much more profound work, and I think something which makes a much bigger statement.
When you look at the whole problem of human trafficking and the incredible suffering, and you start to think of it as slavery, what does the liberation movement look like at this point in history?
I talked to other people who saw the movie, and I asked them that same question, what they felt, because that opinion was very important to me. And many people felt that they would want to educate their own kids to be open to the issue and to educate them to feel that boys and girls are equally worthy. Because even in our Western lives right now, girls do girly things and boys do boyish things, and that's how it has to be. And the girls move over and clean up the dishes, and the boys go and play football, something like that. All those role models are being imprinted. And I think it'd be important to be very open that girls and boys are equally important, and love is for free. You don't have to pay for it. You don't have to go and
buy it.
It's not a good that's available on the market, so to speak, but it should be available to all of us. And I think this would breed a new attitude and a more open, more liberal society, and where those things are less necessary. And if we move in that direction where prostitution is less necessary because love is free and open for everybody and boys and girls are equally as important, I think that would be one way to go.
I think on the plus side, that the recent election really cast a lot of light on this with the whole issues with the war on women. And I would like to think that this film is coming to the public at a time when the world is much more open to making this paradigm shift.
George Giselle and Brooke Fuller are co-writers of the film Little Dancer, which screens on Saturday night at 7:15 at the New Mexico History Museum. It's part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. It will be followed by a panel discussion. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
And once again, the Santa Fe Film Festival is happening through Sunday, the 9th of December. You can find out more information at santafefilmfestival.com. And the locations are all fabulous: the Center for Contemporary Arts, the Lensic, the New Mexico History Museum, and the Screen. There are pocket guides all over town that you can find with the schedule. You can find it online. And you can also call for more information, 505-988-7414.